Welcome to today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, March 8th, 2024. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here is our first story. It's entitled, Biden Delivers Fiery State of the Union. It's written by Zeke Miller and Seong-Min Kim of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Washington. President Joe Biden turned his State of the Union speech Thursday night into an animated argument for a second term as he laced into GOP frontrunner Donald Trump for espousing resentment, revenge, and retribution, and jeopardizing freedom at home and abroad. Over and over, Biden delivered broadsides at my predecessor without mentioning Trump by name, raising his voice as he tried to quell voter concerns about his age and job performance while sharpening the contrast with his all but certain November rival. It was a far different and feistier tone from Biden than in his previous State of the Union address, and it was designed to banish doubts about whether the 81-year-old is still up to the job he bids for a second term. Biden goaded Republicans over their policies, invited call-and-response banter with fellow Democrats, and seemed to revel in the fight. Freedom and democracy are under attack both at home and overseas at the very same time, Biden said as he appealed for Congress to support Ukraine's efforts to defend itself against Russia's invasion. History is watching. Biden quickly pivoted to the threats at home, referencing the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the Capitol by Trump supporters seeking to overturn the 2020 election, and calling for the threat to democracy to be countered. My predecessor, and some of you here, seek to bury the truth about January the 6th. I will not do that, Biden said. This is a moment to speak the truth and to bury the lies. Here's a simple truth. You can't love your country only when you win. My lifetime has taught me to embrace freedom and democracy, Biden said. A future based on the core values that have defined America, honesty, decency, dignity, equality, to respect everyone, to give everyone a fair shot, to give hate no safe harbor. Now some other people my age see a different story, an American story of resentment, revenge, and retribution. That's not me. The president showcased his accomplishments on infrastructure and manufacturing and pushed Congress to approve more aid to Ukraine, tougher migration rules, and lower drug prices. He also sought to remind voters of the situation he inherited when he entered office in 2021 amid a raging pandemic and contracting economy. The 81-year-old president was being closely watched not just for his message but for whether he could deliver it with vigor and command. White House aides said Biden was aiming to prove his doubters wrong by flashing his combative side and trying to needle Republicans over positions he believes are out of step with the country, particularly on access to abortion, but also tax policy and health care. It's part of his campaign year effort to use even official speeches to clarify the choice for voters at the ballot box this fall. Taking a victory lap and selling his legislative accomplishments, such as one that bolsters manufacturing of computer chips nationwide, Biden veered from his prepared script to take a dig at Republicans who voted against such policies but are eager to take credit for them back home. If any of you don't want that money in your districts, Biden said, just let me know. The president was speaking before a historically ineffective Congress. In the GOP-led House, Speaker Mike Johnson took power 5 months ago after the chaotic ouster of former Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Legislators are still struggling to approve funding bills for the current year and have been deadlocked for months on foreign assistance bills to help Ukraine stave off Russia's invasion and support Israel's fight against Hamas. The State of the Union address is a marquee night on the White House calendar, offering presidents a direct line to a captive audience of lawmakers and dignitaries in the House chamber and tens of millions of viewers at home. But even so, the night has lost some of its luster as viewership has declined. Biden aides inside the White House and on his campaign had hoped for some fresh viral moments, like when he tussled last year with heckling Republicans and chided them for past efforts to cut Medicare and Social Security. Johnson, eager to avoid a similar episode this year, urged Republicans in a private meeting Wednesday to show decorum during the speech, according to a person familiar with his remarks to lawmakers. He appeared to have limited success. A number of House Republicans began to stand up and leave the chamber as Biden discussed raising taxes on billionaires and corporations. Others, like Johnson, remained in their chairs and shook their heads. Biden engaged in a loud call and response with lawmakers as he rhetorically questioned whether the tax code was fair and whether billionaires and corporations need another $2 trillion in tax breaks, as he charged Republicans want. One of the most contentious moments of his speech came during his remarks on immigration, when Biden was running down the endorsements by conservative groups of the bipartisan border legislation that Republicans killed last month. Some in the audience appeared to yell and interject, and Biden shot back, "I know you know how to read." As Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, decked out in pro-Trump paraphernalia, continued to shout at Biden, the president held up a white button that the Georgia Republican had handed him earlier bearing the name of Laken Riley, who authorities say was killed by a Venezuelan national who unlawfully crossed into the U.S. in September of 2022. "Laken Riley," Biden said, calling her an innocent young woman who was killed by an illegal. He expressed condolences to her family, saying his heart goes out to them. And the congressional Republican leaders were showcasing one of their newest lawmakers through the State of the Union rebuttal in order to make a generational contrast with Biden. Alabama Senator Katie Britt, the youngest Republican woman elected to the Senate, planned to paint a picture of a nation that seems to be slipping away and one where our families are hurting. "Right now, our commander-in-chief is not in command. The free world deserves better than a dithering and diminished leader," Britt was to say, according to excerpts released Thursday evening. "America deserves leaders who recognize that secure borders, stable prices, safe streets, and a strong defense are the cornerstones of a great nation." Biden painted an optimistic future for the country as the massive pieces of legislation he signed into law during his first 2 years in office are implemented. But he also was set to warn that the progress he sees at home and abroad is fragile and particularly vulnerable if Trump returns to the White House. Trump, for his part, said he planned to respond in real time to Biden's remarks on his Tell Truth social platform. This year, Biden faced heightened emotions, particularly among his base supporters, over his staunch backing for Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza. The White House had initially hoped a short-term ceasefire would be in place by the speech. It blames Hamas for not yet accepting a deal brokered by the U.S. and its allies. A slew of Democrats and Republicans wore pins and stickers in honor of the Israeli hostages still being held captive in Gaza. Meanwhile, several House progressives wore Palestinian keffiyehs, the black and white checkered scarves that have come to symbolize Palestinian solidarity. Biden's motorcade took a circuitous route to the Capitol as hundreds of pro-ceasefire demonstrators tried to disrupt its path from the White House. Amid growing concerns about the dire humanitarian situation in Gaza, Biden announced in his address that he has directed the U.S. military to establish a temporary port on the Gaza coast aimed at increasing the flow of aid into the beleaguered territory. Our next article is entitled High Expectations. Climbing a 52-foot wall isn't challenging enough. Try doing it in the dark. It's written by Earl Horlick. Think climbing a 52-foot rock wall is challenging? Imagine doing it in the dark. That's the concept behind the night climbing event taking place at 6 p.m. March 15th at Long Lines Climbing, 401 Gordon Drive in Sioux City. According to facility manager Alex Irwin, people will be able to watch the documentary Real Rock, which follows the careers of professional climbers Babsi Zangirl, Jacopo Larcher, and Seb Bowen. Since the lights will be turned off for the movie, canny Spider-Man wannabes are encouraged to scale a few walls with headlamps being their guide. "You know the headlamps that miners wear in caves," Irwin said? "Those are the ones that people will be wearing on the walls." Indeed, headlight climb nights are just one of the innovations that the gym inside of the Long Lines Family Rec Center is testing. Irwin is also bringing back the kid-friendly climbing wall summer camp that was successful last year. "Parents loved the summer camps because it gave their children something to do when school's out of session," he explained. "Kids loved it because, compared to mom and dad, they're fearless when it comes to heights." That's something Irwin can relate to. A tree climber as a kid, he became passionate about climbing as a student at Iowa State University. "I love climbing because it tests your physical and mental stamina," Irwin said. "If you rely solely on your body, you'll burn out. Using your mind, you figure which grips to take while charting out the safest path to take," which makes climbing the perfect team-building exercise for corporate types. You really want to be on the same wavelength as your partner when you're 50 feet in the air, Irwin said. However, Irwin would be the first one to admit that he isn't a traditional corporate type. Instead, he is the longtime vocalist for the alt-rock group Ghost Cat. "I'm even booking my band and other bands to perform here, using the landing on top of our 10-foot boulder wall as an impromptu stage," Irwin said. "After all, people who love rock music can also love rock climbing. Even if they don't, Irwin wants to get them in the door. I love the fact that Sioux City has its own climbing gym," he said. "I just think it's a hidden gem that more people should be taking advantage of. While Long Lines Climbing is busiest during the winter, the gym stays open year-round." To increase traffic, Irwin said he enjoys thinking outside of the box, like creating quirky events like wall climbing in the dark. "We have plenty of our headlamps," Irwin said with a smile. "Are you up for the challenge?" The final story on the front page of the journal today is entitled "River Runoff Forecast Remains Below Average." It's written by Nick Heitrick. The dateline is Omaha. "Despite above-average numbers in February, the forecast runoff into the Missouri River above Sioux City in 2024 continues to drop. The warm month led to increased snowmelt and 1.8 million acre-feet of runoff, 161% of average, into the upper basin. The annual runoff forecast dropped from 18.8 MAF to 17.0 MAF, 66% of the average of 25.0 MAF. "Despite the increased runoff in the month of February and improved soil moisture conditions, we expect 2024 runoff to remain below average," John Remus, chief of the Corps' Missouri River Basin Water Management Division, said in a news release. "The much warmer than normal temperatures led to an early melt of the lower than average plains snow. In addition, mountain snowpack is lower than average, resulting in the low annual runoff forecast. Mountain snowpack that feeds the upper river basin when it melts currently ranges from 73% to 78% of average. By March 1st, about 80% of the total mountain snowpack usually has accumulated. Water storage in the river's six reservoirs remains below the flood control zone at 53.9 MAF, below the flood control zone that starts at 56.1 MAF. Despite the low runoff forecast and reservoir water storage, Remus said, the reservoir system will continue to support all purposes, including flood control, navigation, recreation, water supply, and power generation. The system will continue to serve all congressionally authorized purposes during 2024, Remus said. The Corps will continue to monitor basin and river conditions, and dam releases will be adjusted accordingly, Remus said. In March, the Corps will begin to increase releases from Gavin's Point Dam near Yankton, South Dakota, to provide flow support for downstream river navigation. Gavin's Point releases currently remain at the winter rate of 13,000 cubic feet per second. That brings us to a story entitled "Water Leak in New Woodbury County Law Enforcement Center Found Tuesday." This is written by Caitlin Yamada. A water leak was found in the new Woodbury County Law Enforcement Center on Tuesday. At approximately 1:40 a.m. Tuesday, Woodbury County Sheriff's deputies found water leaking in the loading dock, said Shane Albrecht of the Baker Group, a consultant for the project, Thursday. Sheriff's deputies started training in the new jail this week. At around 5:30 p.m., Albrecht said Hausman Construction, the Lincoln, Nebraska-based general contractor, arrived at the facility and found a water line was leaking. Albrecht said security footage showed water leaking from around 10 p.m. Monday. "Thankfully, a lot of the construction in the jail is concrete walls, floors with some drains around it," he said, but added there was damage to the facility, including the fireproofing and ceiling tiles. No project delay is expected because of the damage, Albrecht said, and Hausmann Construction is working to correct the damage and has contacted their insurance provider. Albrecht and LEC Chair Ron Weick said more information will be determined at a later date regarding what happened and who was responsible. The new law enforcement center is expected to open on April the 9th after a series of missing dampers delayed the project. In October 2022, it was announced a series of walls for the facility had fallen due to high winds. Reused and improper selection of anchor bolts, as well as lack of inspections, contributed to the failure of the walls. Next week, Albrecht said the state jail inspector is expected to do a final walk of the project. He said a public statement will be made on the completion date sometime next week after the inspection and review of other aspects of the project. Now we come to a story entitled Spirit Lake Man Arrested on Drug Charges. It's written by Dolly A. Butts, and the dateline is Merrill, Iowa. A Spirit Lake man was arrested Wednesday after leading police on a 20-minute pursuit through Plymouth County, which ended when the vehicle he was driving got stuck in the mud. Jeffrey D. Uhlman, age 34, was booked into the Plymouth County Jail on charges of looting, second offense, a Class C felony, possession of a controlled substance, third or subsequent offense, a Class D felony, and misdemeanor charges of operating while intoxicated, driving while barred, unlawful possession of prescription pills, and possession of drug paraphernalia. According to a criminal complaint filed in Plymouth County District Court, at 8:41 p.m. Wednesday, a Plymouth County deputy attempted to stop a black 2013 Jeep Patriot with dealer plates near Merrill. The deputy recognized Uhlman, who had a barred driver's license, at a gas pump. The deputy activated his vehicle's lights and sirens, but Uhlman failed to pull over. Uhlman led law enforcement on multiple-mile pursuit through Plymouth County, which lasted roughly 20 minutes, according to the complaint. The sheriff's office said in a statement that when the pursuit entered Lamar's, the Lamar's Police Department offered assistance. The pursuit then continued northbound and eastbound on numerous county and state roads in Plymouth County, exceeding 95 miles per hour, the statement said. The vehicle ultimately entered a Level B road near Quest Avenue 140th. The vehicle traveled eastbound on 140th for a short amount of time before getting stuck in the mud. Once the vehicle came to a stop, Uhlman fled on foot. Numerous law enforcement officers from multiple agencies created a perimeter around his location, according to the statement. After 1.5 hours of searching, the O'Brien County Sheriff's Office brought a drone in to the scene. The drone's operator found Uhlman lying down in a field. At this time, two Plymouth County deputies, along with a Lamar's Police Department canine officer, were able to apprehend the suspect and take him into custody, the statement said. According to the complaint, the vehicle had methamphetamine shards and blue pills across the floorboard in the driver's seat area. Some pills were also found in the mud outside of the vehicle along the path Uhlman took when he fled. Uhlman had bloodshot eyes, droopy eyelids, and displayed poor decision-making and poor driving behavior during the pursuit, the complaint stated. The execution of a search warrant resulted in the seizure of a dirty meth needle from the vehicle, as well as a loaded meth pipe, marijuana pipe, and a small amount of marijuana, according to the complaint. Uhlman admitted the dealer plates that had been on the vehicle were given to him by a friend who took them from a dealership and did not belong to the vehicle, the complaint stated. The Remsen Police Department, Orange City Police Department, Sioux County Sheriff's Office, and Cherokee Police Department also assisted the Plymouth County Sheriff's Office. In the interest of focusing on local news, I'll read some stories from the Storm Lake Times-Pilot. First up, owner pleads to let dog back in city after attacks. Council deems the dog vicious. This is written by Amber Mohammed. A husky that was cited 3 times for being on the loose and attacking people was deemed vicious by the Storm Lake City Council and will no longer be allowed in city limits. The City Council affirmed City Manager Carrie Navratil's February decision that deemed Nico, a husky owned by Jose Luis Acosta of Storm Lake, was a vicious animal under city code. A vicious animal is usually a dog that attacks a person or another animal without provocation and causes injury. Navratil said the dog has been spotted off its leash 4 times and has been sighted 3 times, once in February 2023 when it was running at large at the intersection of East 4th and Russell Street. Again in September 2023 when it allegedly tried to attack someone and their dogs, and again last month when it attacked a woman and bit her arm unprovoked. Councilwoman Maggie Martinez told Acosta that she had to apologize to the woman who was attacked last month. "First, I apologize to the community member who got bit by your dog. She is a resident and she lives and works in this community. We need to support her," Martinez said. She said after the meeting, she thinks community members should be able to walk at night without fear of being attacked by a dog. "What happened to her was not right. We have rules and regulations to try to prevent that. It was not her fault. She did not provoke the dog to bite her." Councilwoman Meg McKeon suggested Acosta adopt the dog to a Siberian rescue organization that operates out of Iowa or its neighboring states. "There is a Siberian rescue organization in this state and nearby states," McKeon told Acosta. "So if you're not going to keep the dog or take care of the dog, I suggest you turn the dog over to a rescue so it gets adopted, trained, and cared for by people who are familiar with the breed." Acosta did not respond to McKeon's offer. He left the council chambers after the council rendered its 4-0 decision. Navratil summoned SLPD officers as well as 2 witnesses who either saw Nico on the loose or were attacked by him. Alyssa Solem, a lieutenant with the SLPD, reported to a residence in the 900 block of Lake Avenue last month because of a dog bite. Solem encountered Nico, who would growl each time an officer closed in on him. 5 officers had to subdue Nico, who was later tranquilized and transported to Lake Animal Hospital. "At that time, I made the decision to tranquilize the dog due to its aggressiveness, demeanor, and that an individual was already injured from the biting," Solem told the council. "It took approximately 45 minutes for the medication to get back where the dog ended up laying down in a kennel that was within the resident's backyard." The woman who got bit by Nico last month, Lizbeth Zhang, said she was attacked by the dog after she and her husband brought it home after they saw it running around the area. "It appeared to be friendly, but it attacked when they got home. The council viewed video footage of the attack. The issue was when we actually got home," Zhang told the city council Monday. "It didn't do anything to my husband, just me. Immediately after he bit me, the dog went calm and sat right next to my husband." Zhang was taken to Buena Vista Regional Medical Center to treat the dog bite. 7 months before the attack, the SLPD responded to the 600 block of Superior because of a dog that was trying to attack other dogs. Officer Gerardo Bravo responded. He found Nico, brought him back to Acosta, and informed him of city code. He also advised him to fix his fence and keep the dog in his kennel. Navratil said before the meeting, "The dog's attempts and demonstrable violence last month showed the dog was indeed vicious." Acosta never denied the city's claims. He pleaded with the council to allow his son's dog back in Storm Lake because it was marooned on a ranch in Marathon with no one to care for him. He said he got the dog for his son, and hence he was advocating for his son. Councilwoman Ramos asked Acosta what measures would be taken for the community's safety if the dog was brought back within city limits. Acosta responded that he would be open to installing an electric fence to keep the dog from running outside their property or keep it in the basement so it wouldn't harm other community members. But the city council wasn't convinced. McKeon expressed concern for the dog and whether it could have a good quality of life if it was returned to Acosta. "What I'm hearing also makes me concerned for the dog," McKeon said. "I'm concerned about approach, perhaps attitudes towards caring for an animal, and just not understanding the huge responsibility that it takes to have a pet, to take care of the pet, to take care of the family, and to take care of the community." Councilwoman Martinez told Acosta it's understandable that he'd want to keep his son happy, but she added that sometimes a parent has to tell their child no. She told Acosta that while the attack might not be Acosta's fault, it's his responsibility to address the dog's behavior. "I'm also a grandmother and a mother, and I like to make my kids happy too," Martinez said to Acosta. "So sometimes as a parent, it's unfortunate you'd have to make them unhappy because something bad happened." Next, Tyson settles 3 COVID lawsuits. One case from BV remains. This is written by Tom Cullen. The estates of 3 deceased Tyson Food workers dismissed their lawsuits against the companies because they settled 3 weeks ago. Mary Hamilton, a Storm Lake attorney representing the estates of Ken Jones of Alta, Juan Samudio of Storm Lake, and Victor Barahona Rivera of Storm Lake, told the Storm Lake Times-Pilot the estates settled with Tyson last month for undisclosed amounts. On Tuesday, each of the estates dismissed their lawsuits against the company with prejudice, meaning their claims can't be refiled. Hamilton declined to specify a settlement amount and declined further comment. An email to a company spokesperson wasn't immediately returned. The settlements leave 1 more lawsuit against the company in Buena Vista County for operating its Storm Lake plant through the coronavirus pandemic. The estate of Michael Everhard of Fonda is awaiting a trial that'll be set at a later date. The Everhard Estates lawsuit is awaiting a ruling from the Iowa Supreme Court on whether wrongful death lawsuits against meatpacking plants should be heard in district court or administrative workers' compensation proceedings. Blackhawk County District Court Judge John Sullivan ruled the Waterloo plaintiffs didn't meet the requested standard for a jury to hear their lawsuits. Most cases involving workplace death and injury are held in administrative workers' compensation proceedings, which awards compensation strictly on earning potential of a decedent. A district court action requires demonstrating gross negligence or reckless disregard for the safety of others. In other words, the plaintiffs needed to prove that the company knew about the danger the virus posed and that the danger would probably cause injuries. The Everhard estate is facing the same issues. The damage amounts in workers' compensation proceedings are much lower than what a jury could award if the company was found liable for the deaths. Buena Vista County District Court Judge Nancy Wittenberg said she will proceed on the Everhard Estates lawsuit once the Supreme Court rules on the Waterloo appeals. The 3 plaintiffs' estates, which settled their claims, had sued the company in June of 2022, around 2 years after they all died from COVID-19. The estates claim Jones, Samudio, and Rivera contracted COVID-19 at the pork plant. The suits alleged the 3 plaintiffs weren't distanced more than 6 feet apart or shielded with PPE and physical barriers, flouting OSHA and IDPH guidelines that advised them to do so. The suits also claim the company didn't make adequate preparations for workers over 65 years old or those who have pre-existing conditions. The suit also claims the county's COVID-19 infection rate skyrocketed after the disease spread through the Tyson plants. In the summer of 2020, Buena Vista County was the hottest of hot spots in the nation for COVID-19. Willis Hamilton, a Storm Lake attorney representing the Everhard estate, claims the county's infection skyrocketed because of testing results the company submitted to the Iowa Department of Public Health. The company kept operating, but eased its attendance policies and later required its employees to be vaccinated against COVID-19. Now we'll read the editorial from the Storm Lake Times-Pilot, and it's entitled, "Our Animal Problem." Storm Lake has an animal control problem. The city council just heard from a man who wants to bring his exiled, aggressive dog back into the city. Pedestrians walk with baseball bats after reports of vicious dog attacks. Lake Animal Hospital begs for a solution as it is overwhelmed by costs of sheltering neglected or stray animals. A friend was walking down Irving Street a few weeks ago and was charged by 2 huge white dogs. Fortunately, he averted violence. He was frightened for sure. Earlier, another friend was walking her little poodle when it was attacked by a much bigger dog, Kitty Corner, from the 2 huge white dogs. Nearby, a dog with a misnomer of amigo barks in booms. Little dogs yip and get the big dogs going. It's like living in the pound. Stray cats roam the lake shore in search of birds. people hoard cats and dogs until the police have to show up, clear out the herd, and take the animals to Lake Animal Hospital for treatment and refuge with an uncertain fate. It strikes us that Storm Lake needs an animal control officer and a shelter that is not the fiscal responsibility of Lake Animal Hospital. Who wants to bother the police with the barking or stray dog? They can knock on the door and tell the owner to quiet the dog. After the officer leaves, the dog gets chained up outside for the rest of the day to complain to anyone within earshot. The problem, of course, is not dogs or cats. The problem is people. There's no education we are aware of. What are the rules on strays or incessant barking? Should you feed those cats down at the lake? How much would a neuter and release program cost? The city council has started to talk about too many animals in the hands of people who don't know how to care for them. It's a good start. It will take money. Many people consider this a nuisance at least, or a public safety issue at worst. It is a city concern that the council should address in a systemic way. We need an animal control officer to free up police and to educate people about proper care. We need an animal shelter to free up Lake Animal Hospital. It's good that the council is making this a priority. It will make a difference when the budget reflects it. And a second editorial, immigration politics. The Iowa Senate this week passed a bill along party lines that will make it a crime for an undocumented immigrant to be in Iowa if they have been previously deported. The law sets up a legal conflict with federal authority over immigration and duplicates an existing federal law that already establishes up to a 1-year prison sentence for illegal reentry. We personally have witnessed a federal district court judge warn first-time detainees, most of them young fathers, that if they return, they will go to prison. The state law is not needed. It will only force unnecessary expenses onto counties for what is already a federal responsibility. This is not really about justice or public safety. It's all about politics. The legislature is trying out all sorts of ways to hassle immigrants. It's the leading issue for Donald Trump, an issue that he does not want to solve by assenting to a bipartisan border package approved by Senate leadership and rejected by the House. Buena Vista County has among the densest of immigrant populations in Iowa, if not America. Repeat illegal entry simply is not a problem here that demands a new law and burden of enforcement. Police already have full authority to arrest and hold for deportation any immigrant with a warrant out or anyone who has committed a crime. It is not at all clear that they can act as immigration agents under this Senate bill. The message is nonetheless heard by our new neighbors. You are not welcome here. That's not good for Storm Lake or Denison or even those dying towns without immigrants to support them. We are sending every message possible that we really don't like different people and that we don't really care what your harrowing story might be. That's not a position that Iowa can afford as Pocahontas builds a new jail on a declining population base. Our priorities are askew. And those editorials are written by Art Cullen. You're listening to the Sioux City Journal with some stories from the Storm Lake Times pilot on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. There are new obituaries in the Sioux City Journal, but there are a couple here in the Storm Lake Times pilot. First, John Cruz. John E. Cruz, 74, of Storm Lake, died March 4th at Methodist Manor Retirement Community in Storm Lake after a battle with cancer. Funeral Mass will take place Saturday, March the 9th at 10:30 a.m. at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Storm Lake. Burial will be in the church cemetery. Visitation will take place Friday, March 8th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Fratsky and Jensen Funeral Home in Storm Lake, with a vigil service at 7:30 p.m. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the local Buena Vista County Ducks Unlimited, care of Travis Bethune, B-E-T-H-U-N-E, 1868 600th Street, Newell, Iowa, 50568. John Freddy Cruz was born August the 5th, 1949, at Spencer Municipal Hospital to John and Frederica Shepherd Cruz of Marathon. Throughout his school years, John was active in sports and music. He graduated from Marathon High School, then went on to attend Buena Vista University in Storm Lake. He graduated with a double major in math and physics, an Iowa teaching certification, and a minor in accounting. John was united in marriage to Colleen Rice on September the 11th, 1969 at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Storm Lake. They were blessed with three children, Lance, Kimberly, and Gregory. From 1975 to 2000, John worked at Bill Maher Foods in Storm Lake, where he started as supervisor, then plant engineer. In the year 2000, John began his career with Walling Water Management of Sioux Falls, South Dakota. He retired in 2012. In 2014, John began his second venture as owner and operator of Lake Inspection Service, LLC. He also acquired his Iowa substitute teacher license and enjoyed teaching all ages. John will be remembered for his leadership roles and contributions to the city of Storm Lake. He served as a Storm Lake City Council member for 10 years and Storm Lake mayor for 18 years, with his last term ending December 31, 2017. John served as president of Northwest Iowa League of Cities, member of Northwest Iowa Planning and Development Commission, chairman of the Buena Vista County Emergency Management Commission, and chairman of Buena Vista County Trails Advisory Council. He also served as president of Rotary International. John was an outdoor enthusiast. He enjoyed all types of hunting and fishing, trapping, camping, boating, and wildlife viewing. John also enjoyed volunteering for various organizations, including the Buena Vista Swan Restoration Committee and Ducks Unlimited. He played an integral part in the startup of the walleye egg gathering in Storm Lake with Iowa DNR fisheries biologist Lanny Miller. He continued to help with netting and egg harvest for over 30 years. John's service to his community will never be forgotten. He was preceded in his death by his parents, John and Frederica Shepherd Crude. And our second obituary is for Betty Garlock. After a full and active 93 years, Betty Garlock of Waukee, formerly of Fonda, died March 3rd, surrounded by family. A graveside service was held March 7th at Fonda Center Cemetery with Pastor Greg Bakersville in officiating. Betty was born August 16, 1930, to Elmer and Irene Herkey. She was raised on a farm near Fonda, where she developed her love of gardening, flowers, animals, and the outdoors. Although a country girl, she lived in town with her grandma during the school year so she could attend the new Fonda Public School, from which she graduated. In 1953, Betty married Dale Garlock at Fonda United Church of Christ, where she was a lifelong member. A bookkeeper at heart and by training, Betty was thrust into newspaper life when Dale purchased the Fonda Times, and they returned to their hometown where they raised three children. For several years, he produced the famous Fonda Foods feature, which took her into hundreds of homes to gather recipes from homemakers. Eventually, Betty took a full-time position as secretary at Fonda Community School and later bookkeeper at Cargill. Upon retirement, when she had more time for crafting and dried floral arranging, she and a friend opened a gift shop on Main Street. In 2011, Betty moved to Waukee to be near family. There, she enjoyed playing and teaching bridge, watching her flower and vegetable garden, tended by her son, grow, and getting to attend the activities of her grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Ernst Funeral and Cremation Service of Waukee has been entrusted with final arrangements. And as you all know, Daylight Savings Time starts this weekend, and here's a timely article entitled, Beat the Clock, A Guide to Springing Forward Without Disrupting Your Slumber. Comes from the Mayo Clinic. Most U.S. states and many countries follow Daylight Savings Time. During Daylight Saving Time, clocks are turned forward by 1 hour. Later, they're turned back. For example, in the U.S., Daylight Savings Time starts in March and ends in November. In other countries, time changes happen at different times of the year. These shifting times may make it harder to get good sleep. Regardless of the time of year, good sleep is important. And with a little tweaking, you can ease the effect time changes have and get the rest you need. Time changes and the sleep cycle. An hour shift in the time of day affects the amount of sunlight your body gets. Suddenly, the walk to the school bus stop in the morning is dark, or you're going to bed when it's not fully dark outside. Why does that matter to sleep? Exposure to light helps control the body's internal clock, also called circadian rhythm. Morning light tells the body it's time to wake up. Darkness says it's time to sleep. Daylight saving time has been linked to unhealthy shifts in this 24-hour sleep cycle, as well as higher risks of health and safety issues. These include heart problems, strokes, and car crashes. Spring forward and yawn. Turning the clock forward an hour may temporarily steal the spring in your step. Some have compared its effects to jet lag. After this time change, you might feel sleepy or restless for a day or two. It's usually worse the day after the time change. For example, if the clocks get set back an hour overnight from a Saturday into Sunday, you may notice it more on Monday. For some people, it takes up to a week or longer to adjust. Springing forward may be especially tough for kids. Children and teens may be more at risk of the negative side effects of lack of sleep. Not getting enough sleep is linked to problems with concentration, behavior, learning, and depression. Resync your family's sleep clock. Make healthy sleep a priority for you and your family. These four steps can help you prevent some sleep troubles related to seasonal time changes. Number one, adjust your bedtime. Go to bed about 15 minutes early each night, starting a few days before the time change. This can help your body adjust. Number two, dim the light. After moving the clocks ahead an hour, the sun may still be shining when it's time for some family members to go to bed. Room darkening blinds or curtains can help it feel more like nighttime. Also, avoid electronics. The screens make you more alert, not sleepy. Number three, get the right amount of sleep. If you're already short on sleep when the time change strikes, it's harder to adjust. Adults need at least 7 hours of sleep every night. Children need more. And number four, exercise. Working out helps signal to the body that it's time to get going in the morning. Looking ahead to fall, turning the clocks back when daylight savings time ends can help you get more sleep for one night, but you may feel a bit more tired in the days to come. Falling back means less light in the mornings. Waking up to go to work or to school when it's still dark can be tough. One way to beat the fall back blues? Soak in some light first thing in the morning. It tells your brain to wake up. For ways to do this, open the blinds before you go to bed so the sun shines in as soon as it rises. Go outside as soon as possible once the sun comes up. Use a timer to turn on a bedroom lamp before your morning alarm goes off. And if sunshine is scarce, try a light box. Now we turn to some sports, and we've got the 2024 All Times Pilot Girls Hoops team from the Storm Lake Times Pilot. It was a unique year in the area in girls basketball, to simply put it. There were a lot of standout players. So much so that the usual cast of six players on the first team was expanded to nine. The two dominant teams in the area were represented the most, as Sioux Central and Newell Fonda each landed three players on the elite team. The team also features the area's leading scorer and rebounder by average per game, a player in the top three in scoring, scoring average, rebounds, assists, and steals, and a player who led the entire state in all classes in assists. So without further ado, here is the 2024 All Times Pilot Girls Basketball Team. This is a rather lengthy article, so in the interest of time, I will just read the players' names. On the first team, we've got Adia Yanga from Storm Lake, Morgan Christian from Sioux Central, Madison Stowater of Ridgeview, McKenna Severs of Newell Fonda, Brady Krager of Sioux Central, Kiera Youngers of Newell Fonda, Avery Wilson of Sioux Central, Kinsey Hinders of Newell Fonda, and Nora Peterson of Alta Aurelia. On the second team, Avery DeHaan of Storm Lake, Maddie Raveling of Storm Lake, Isabel Bartek of Newell Fonda, Ella Nielsen of Alta Aurelia, Grace Kenkel of Storm Lake, Claire Wandry from Ridgeview, and Presley Pearson from Sioux Central. Another short article here. Youngers, Seavers, and Krager make first team All-State. Five area girls basketball players were selected to the Iowa Girls Coaches Association All-State teams. Three players from state runner-up Newell Fonda were represented. Kiera Youngers and McKenna Seavers were both Class 1A first-team picks, while Kinsey Hinders was a second-team choice. State semifinalist Sioux Central had two players represented, as Brady Krager was voted to the Class 2A first team, and Morgan Christian was selected to the second team. And Storm Lake's Yanga is the 2024 Times Pilot Player of the Year, written by Jamie Knapp. Trying to find a weakness with Adia Yanga as a basketball player is almost impossible. She doesn't have many, if any at all. The Storm Lake junior can score, rebound, pass, block shots, and handle the ball like a guard. She ranked in the top five in the Lakes Conference in every major statistical category and was a dominating force. That's why Yanga has been chosen as the 2024 Times Pilot Girls Basketball Player of the Year. Yanga scored 348 points in 22 games for an average of 15.8 a game. She tallied 118 rebounds, 57 assists, and 30 steals while blocking 36 shots. Yanga made 137 of 235 field goal attempts for 58.3% and was 73 of 112 from the free throw line for 65.2%. In college baseball news, 7-run inning hurts BVU in loss to Immaculata. Immaculata University scored runs in all but one inning as the Mighty Macs handed Buena Vista a 19-7 loss in seven innings on Tuesday in Auburndale, Florida. Immaculata used the two-out rally in each of the first two innings, scoring three first-inning runs and adding one more in the second to build a 4-0 lead. BVU got on the scoreboard in the second inning with two runs of its own. Brandon Jenkins walked and later came around to score on a wild pitch for the first run, while former Storm Lake prep Jake Eddy doubled and scored on a ground out by Jordan Mathewson. The floodgates began to open in the third inning as the Mighty Macs scored seven runs, including a grand slam home run to extend their lead to 11-2. The Beavers got an RBI ground out in their half of the third before RBIs from Evan Taylor and Drew Taylor in the fourth brought them back within 11-5. Two more runs by the Mighty Macs in the fifth, followed by a five-run sixth inning, all but put the game out of reach at 18-5. Seventh inning doubles by Harris and Eddie capped the scoring for the Beavers. Eddie finished 4-for-4 to set a career high in hits and also scored twice. Drew Taylor and Zach Sale also doubled for BVU as the Beavers tallied five extra base hits. Mason Gelling suffered his first loss of the season after allowing six runs on just two hits while walking seven over two innings. The Beavers used six different pitchers in the game and walked a season-high 10 batters. Only three of the Mighty Macs' 19 hits went for extra bases. Buena Vista is now 6 wins and 3 losses overall and played St. John Fisher on Thursday. And in college softball, BVU swept in pair of close games in Florida. Buena Vista wrapped up its spring trip on Wednesday night with a pair of thrilling games, but the Beavers would ultimately come up short in both, falling to Dominican University from Illinois 10-7 and then to Wittenberg 1-0 in Kissimmee, Florida. Against the Stars, it was BVU that put together multiple rallies during the game, but the final one saw the team score three runs in the seventh inning before leaving the bases loaded to end the game. Dominican had jumped out to a 3-0 lead in the first inning and continued to lead by that same margin until the fourth, when the Beavers tied it up at 3-3 with a three-run triple by Amanda Frankie. It was a five-run fifth inning by the Stars that ultimately proved to be the deciding factor. They played small ball against BVU to score a pair of runs on bunt singles. Kirsten Trait doubled to score Nicky Griggs in the sixth inning with an RBI double that brought the Beavers within 8-4. But Dominican had another response in the bottom half by plating two more to make it 10-4. BVU put its rally caps on yet again in the seventh inning as Trait came through in the clutch with a three-run double to cut the deficit to 10-7 with two outs. The Beavers later loaded the bases, but a pop-out to short ended both the rally and the game. Trait finished 2-for-4 with four RBIs, while Frankie turned in two hits and three RBIs, and Griggs was 2-for-2 with two runs scored. Kelly Earlmeyer made the start in the circle, but was lifted after allowing three runs and two hits over just one-third of an inning. Kenzie Dumbaugh took over and ultimately suffered her first loss of the season. She was tagged with seven runs, five earned, and seven hits over 5 2/3 innings. The Beavers looked to bounce back in the nightcap against Wittenberg and end the trip on a winning note. The game turned into a pitcher's duel as the teams combined for just 11 total hits, with only one going for extra bases. Wittenberg scored a run in the first on an RBI groundout that proved to be the game's only run. BVU threatened in the bottom half with three base hits, but a lineout turned into a double play, ending the inning. The Beavers threatened again in the fifth after a double by Jillian Garcia put runners at first and second with two outs, but they couldn't get the big hit when it counted and both runners were stranded. Kennedy Claycomb was tough in the circle all game long for BVU, allowing just one run and five hits, including one base hit over the final three innings. She finished the game with a pair of strikeouts and did not walk a batter. Garcia finished 2-for-4 at the plate for the Beavers as the team totaled six hits. Buena Vista went 3-for-3 on the trip and is now 7-9 overall. The Beavers play at Augustana, Illinois on March 17th. Here's some men's college basketball news from the top 25. Washington spoils rivals' Pac-12 title hopes. Corin Johnson scored 23 points, Keon Brooks Jr. added 22, and Washington knocked off number 18 Washington State 74-68 in the final Pac-12 conference matchup between the cross-state rivals. Johnson nailed a corner three-pointer with a minute 21 left that proved to be the final blow, putting the Huskies up 68-61. Washington State failed to get stops at critical moments and shot 4 of 24 from three-point range. The Cougars were hoping for their first conference title since 1941. To get it, they needed a win and one Arizona loss in its final two games, or two Arizona losses. And by the time Washington State's game against Washington was over, Arizona was well on its way to beating UCLA. As for the Huskies, they spoiled what had been a charmed season at home for the Cougars in the final meeting between the schools as members of the Pac-12. The rivalry is likely to continue, but it will be with the Cougars in the West Coast Conference and the Huskies in the Big Ten. It was Washington's first road win over a ranked opponent since beating Kansas on December the 6th of 2017. And number 7, Arizona 88, UCLA 65. K.J. Lewis scored 18 points, Caleb Love added 17, and the Wildcats routed the Bruins in Los Angeles to clinch the regular season conference title in their final season in the league. Arizona is headed to the Big 12 next season, while the Bruins are bound for the Big 10. Jaden Bradley added 13 points for Arizona, which had five players in double figures while winning its fourth in a row. The Wildcats earned their first win at Pauley Pavilion under third-year coach Tommy Lloyd, who was 0-2 in the building. Here's some news from around the Major League Baseball first spring breakout. Baltimore infielder Jackson Holliday, Milwaukee outfielder Jackson Chourio, and Pittsburgh right-hander Paul Skenes headline rosters for the inaugural spring breakout designed to showcase top prospects. Each of the 30 major league organizations announced rosters for the event, which includes 16 games from March 14th through 17th at spring training sites. From the Atlanta Braves, Michael Harris II hit his third Grapefruit League homer, a third-inning drive off Boston's Tanner Houck in the Braves' 3-2 victory. Harris is 8 of 18 with 6 runs and 5 RBIs. From the Texas Rangers, Jared Walsh hit an RBI single in Texas's 7-5 victory over Arizona Diamondbacks and has reached base in 10 of his 20 plate appearances this spring. From the Chicago Cubs, manager Craig Counsell told reporters that right-hander Caleb Killian has a teres major strain and is expected to be out until the All-Star break. Killian was 0-1 with a 16.88 ERA in 3 appearances for Chicago last season. The Oakland Athletics returned to Las Vegas this weekend for exhibition games against Milwaukee, their first appearance since announcing the relocation to what the team envisions as its future home city. The games will be played at Las Vegas Ballpark, home of the franchise's AAA Aviators. And former All-Star catcher Mike Zunino is retiring at age 32 after 11 major league seasons. Zunino hit .199 with 149 homers and 372 RBIs for Seattle, Tampa Bay, and Cleveland. Here's scores from around the NBA last night. Detroit, .118. Brooklyn, .112. Minnesota defeated Indiana, .113-.111. Dallas, .114. Miami, .108. Phoenix, .120. Toronto, .113. Chicago, .125. Golden State, .122. Denver, .115. Boston, .109. And Sacramento, .131. San Antonio, .129. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Sioux City Journal, along with stories from the Storm Lake Times Pilot. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.